Getting back to the subterfuge of the Howard Hughes body that isn't in the grave, I've referred many times on this program to that show, Good Morning America. It was December 15, 1976, 5 years ago, ABC TV, where it was said before David Hartman that Vance Cooper is buried in the Texas grave and it's not Howard Hughes. And I never can figure out why people don't ask, well, who is it then? What is going on? Grant Greenspun, the publisher of the Las Vegas Sun, was also on television, and this was right after the Hughes body was cashed in 1976. And he said on the TV show, which I taped and typed up, he said Howard Hughes was one of the great despoilers of our political system. And if he were permitted to go unrestrained, he would have destroyed the government, which he helped make. And if that wasn't used, then the spoiling is going on. If the people who have had the power haven't been checked, then the same system is being destroyed, the political system, and I believe it is. He went on, Dan Greenspun, he was talking, he say, they may say that we're walking on a man's grave because Hughes' body had just been cashed in, or that was Vance Cooper's, but this man has to be explored. We have to get to the bottom and find out all the evils that befall our form of government. It should be a framework for future generations not to get trapped in. We must protect what we have here. Just as you have to watch the political system, the same methods have to be employed where you have this extraordinary wealth, overwhelming wealth, that it influences the political system and undermines it to agree where the whole system can collapse. We must examine Howard Hughes because he was the arch corrupter of the political system, and we must keep re-examining him over and over again, whether he's alive or whether he's dead. And that is the only reason I bring this up, because the public must be aware of the hold this man had on the government of the United States. Now, this was a program, April 25th, 1976, Hank Greenspan said that. And the man that Howard Hughes, the non-existent Hughes, whoever the organization is and was, and it is the CIA and it was the CIA, selected Paul Laxalt as their president of the United States. But Paul Laxalt is very active in the Senate, and he ran Ronald Reagan's campaign. He's the man that was with him in every city, every state, every speech, and he's the liaison from Congress to the president of the United States. So Paul Laxalt should be exposed because he also told people, and Jack Anderson wrote about it, and I've mentioned this many times, that he didn't think Hughes was in Vegas, but he gave them the right to buy these nightclubs, which have extensive skimming money and unlimited money, again, to buy guns and narcotics and various methods of control for politicians to come through. So if Paul Laxalt were not in the White House right now as the advisor to the President of the United States, if he didn't manage his campaign, if he wasn't the selected agent of whoever buried Vance Cooper in Texas, then what do they have in mind with Paul Laxalt? And shouldn't he be put under question about how the governor of the state of Nevada, he allowed the subterfuge of a man named Hughes not even being there, taken away by Intertel that took off all the clubs, the Vegas clubs there that Hughes had, flew this double or body out, which is literally kidnapping, took it different countries, and then buried this other person. Everyone who had a finger in that is responsible for what's going to happen to us in the future. And the only way to solve the problems of the future, I believe, are to follow, say, open the grave and trace it around and find out why Paul Laxalt and Intertel and these people used a non-existent use as the cover for what they were doing, and was their cover Mr. Reagan, and why should we get a man hoisted on us who doesn't belong there? When Johnny Meyer had this press conference in Vancouver, I called the White House because I got that news on a Friday night, the Vancouver Sun, paper. And I called the White House this Saturday, and they said nobody is there. And I said, I would like to speak to a secretary of the President of the United States. This is the weekend before the inauguration. They said, nobody takes messages. I said, I know he's at Camp David, but you don't have any secretary, no press secretary, no Secret Service. If there were a plan to kill Jimmy Carter or Ronald Reagan, there's nobody. They said, call back on Monday. Nobody takes a message at the White House on the weekend. So that is the way it was before this president took the oath of office. And I don't think he should have had that oath of office. If Laxalt and Intertel and those people with such subterfuge had to go through this extent to put him in, do we have to take what he dishes out to us as if he were the legitimate president of the United States? All the other candidates and past president had been murdered. That made the way for the conveyor belt. And I think that we have a right to know how much subterfuge is going on. A mother died this last week, Oswald's mother, just last Sunday. It was January the 19th, actually. She passed away. She was in a hospital. Nobody knew she was there. She was admitted. It was secret. The press, no family, nobody knows how she expired. They said she died of cancer, but so did Jack Ruby. He had 3-week cancer, and so did Martha Mitchell. She claimed until her death that her son did not kill the President of the United States. He was a decoy. He was in a building and agreed to leave, but he didn't shoot a rifle or have a rifle, and I always agreed with her. She said she had been victimized, that she knew that her son, had never been a part of the assassination, the actual shooting or the firing. She said he was an undercover agent, a double agent, and she was isolated by the researchers, and that's one of the things I never understood. She said he was an agent for the CIA and for the FBI in the Soviet Union, and that he was framed because he knew in advance that John Kennedy was going to be killed, and he informed the FBI. He did go to the Western Union and sent a wire, but the name Oswald was going to be used in Chicago, and it was also set up that there would be a patsy similar to this with the plans to kill John Kennedy in Miami a few weeks earlier. She tried desperately to stop the exhuming of Oswald's body. Marina Oswald wants it. As you know, Marina Oswald has said, I've kept silent for 17 years, and I'm 99% sure that Oswald isn't there. Marguerite, and I've mentioned this many times, was quiet about the fact if Oswald had left the Dallas-Fort Worth area or whether or not he was in that grave. But she wanted to clear his name of being the assassin of John Kennedy. And very tragically, she died in a hospital with no writers, researchers, or people that could speak with her. And goodness knows how long her cancer was with her. She claimed that she was followed all over wherever political figures were, and that her house was bugged and that she was under surveillance. Penn Jones in Texas once said to me that he believed that the accident in our family that took place December 1970 could have been a result of my going to Texas and being in the home of Mrs. Oswald, meeting her and sharing information with her. I have many letters from her and correspondence through the years. And when we stayed at a motel in Texas near her home, after we checked in, a man stood outside where the cars were and cracked a bullwhip almost all night. And we went to another motel the next day, but we were under surveillance, and everybody who met with Marguerite Oswald was under surveillance, and we were very aware of that at the time. She died January the 19th, 1981, and the book of David Lifton's was reviewed January 19th, 1981. There are very many deaths of people just at the time that a new book or information is coming out. Time magazine has a 2-page article on now a 2-casket argument, and it has to do with David Lifton's book, Best Evidence. David, I mentioned him briefly one evening, and I just received the book when I was away in L.A., and I came back. David sent me a copy of the book, and I'll be reading it very carefully because there's a lot of interest in that book for all of us to read. He is a very precise researcher, a good researcher, and although he may have disclaimers to a larger conspiracy that I've mentioned before, what he has is good. And this is an interesting fact that the Book of the Month Club has taken it as a selection, and I hope you'll all read it. I received from a listener a article about the book and some documents in the book, and a long article from Dallas Morning News, January the 11th, 1981. Referring to the book, there's a memo of Dr. James Humes. He did the autopsy of John Kennedy that was so controversial, the Navy commander at Bethesda Hospital. And this document came 4 months after Oswald was buried. And so in the book, there are parts of the double Oswalds, and that is the book that I have done 17 years research and want to put together very shortly. I was hoping January the 1st I could speed in. The book is done and all the research is finished, and add to that and finish that book. But to add to it, in the book Best Evidence, there's much reference to, again, the possibility of exhuming Oswald. This isn't the double coffin that he writes about with John Kennedy. David's book has a memo from Mr. Slauson, an attorney. He teaches law at UCLA, and it has to do with exhuming Lee Harvey Oswald. And I think that's interesting that the Warren Commission wanted to exhume Oswald. The memo calls attention to the fact that they were curious about suicide scars on the arm of Lee Harvey Oswald, and the autopsy didn't show those scars, and the Warren Commission in April considered exhuming him, and according to this Dallas paper, the CIA was in favor of it, but J. Edgar Hoover wasn't. I think the CIA plants certain documents to their own interest. I don't think the CIA is any clinger than J. Edgar Hoover's FBI. They were all involved in the assassination, but they knew that J. Edgar Hoover wouldn't approve and was reluctant to exhume Oswald, and therefore they could say, well, we wanted it, but he didn't. Now, in April of 1964, this crazy diary of Lee Harvey Oswald's appeared. It was a planted diary. It was a forged diary. It was presented to Henry Luce in Life magazine by Gerald Ford of the Warren Commission. And in June 1964, Gerald Ford was meeting with people from Time and Life magazine and the Luce organization. And if you want to look up the diary of Lee Harvey Oswald, it's in Life magazine, July the 10th, 1964. The original diary was never seen, but this diary had a lot of misspelling and a lot of sayings that Lee Harvey Oswald couldn't possibly have written. But among the effort to make him look like a total idiot who couldn't spell or think, it goes into what was supposed to be a suicide attempt in Russia. Well, the diary was planted and forged, and the body didn't show the wrist on it. So one of the necessities for exhuming the body and getting rid of it was at that time that the body didn't have the suicide marks on it that the planted diary talked about and the autopsy report didn't show. Remember, I've read on the program the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings where Earl Warren said in January of 1964, we better exhume that body and cremate it because there's something on that body and the nation couldn't stand another shock. Well, one of the important pieces of evidence to lend the idea that Lee Harvey Oswald was guilty was going to be this great diary. I don't know where it exists, never fingerprinted, never really seen. The Warren Commission was given, in quotes, a copy of it. But the chain of command was this ridiculous telltale diary of about a suicide, and the body buried in Texas didn't have the scars, and the FBI didn't have them. So they had to reconcile the body they had with the diary, which involved Earl Warren, the Chief Justice of the United States, Nicholas Katzenbach, the Deputy Attorney General, now big executive for IBM. These were big league lawyers from the top down, along with Gerald Ford, who was to become President of the United States, and Leon Jaworski, who was on the Warren Commission and investigated the Korea Gate and the Senate Watergate hearings, the top dogs of the country were playing around with all kinds of planted and forged evidence and the wrong bodies. So they were going to have this cremated. But the memo that's described in the Dallas newspaper, Sunday, January the 11th, talks about the discussion of exhuming Oswald after 4 months. Everything that the Warren Commission did was a hot potato, and they had to cover the evidence with their story, and this is the way the great government agents work. One of the most disgusting things is that Mr. Slauson was asked about the memos he sent and about exhuming Oswald, and he had a comment that was in the newspaper. That was 17 years ago, and if I said it, I said it, but I'm not interested, and he passed it off. He's a professor of law at UCLA, and he's saying now, I don't even want to listen to what I wrote about in 1964. Well, I've been doing this research since November 1963, and I would like to know what I wrote or said and compare it with the evidence, see if it stands up, which the research has stood up to, and he should be responsible. And this excuse, a law professor now saying, oh, don't bother me, that was 17 years ago, is inexcusable. He ought to be kicked off the faculty. It's a state university, and we pay his salary. And this kind of incompetence should be totally removed from the scene. But no, he'll go on to a new young generation of law students, and they'll say, this is the prestigious teacher who taught you law. Probably a criminal law he's teaching there, wouldn't you want to bet? Investigative law or evidence or prosecution or whatever. Goodness knows what he is teaching in the university. And at the time that he had this case in his hands, he had memos about exhuming, and they had evidence that the body was ordered to be cremated, and anything that important, it's really hard to believe that he, 17 years later, he doesn't know what's going on. But this was one of the hot potatoes the Warren Commission had all along. There's an interesting article this week in anticipation of what the future Reagan administration will be. It's called A King and Wizard in Waiting, and it's by Mike Weiss. It was in the LA Times. It's about one of my very favorite people. Oh, it's the San Francisco Chronicle, January 19th. Mitchell Werbel. It says, the Wizard of Silent Death. This is the man who makes the silencers, the M10 machine guns, and so forth. The Wizard of Silent Death is sitting with the Pearl of Pearls, His Majesty, the pretender to the throne in Afghanistan. The article says, a king and a wizard in waiting, an Afghan exile, and his military advisors have their hopes. And it shows a man who's been deposed since he was a couple of months old or 2 years old from Afghanistan, sitting with Mitchell Werbel, who's been made a royal free commander of the Royal Free Afghan Army. And Werbel is training this person in his school in Georgia to go back and fight in Afghanistan so that, and he's been promised a seat on the throne. We are planning to go to Chaman, and that's off the record, the wizard said. He's known as Mitchell Livingston Werbel III, founder and director of Cobra International, an anti-terrorist training center located in Atlanta, Georgia, on 66 wooded and rolling acres. Werbel, I've talked about him many, many times, working with Turpel, Corcola, Samuel Cummings, the CIA, arming the world, and he works with the anti-Castro Cubans. They're involved in killing Letelier and Sandra Moffat, fighting the military junta in Chile. And I believed often that his silencers could have been used at Dealey Plaza, that in all the information written about the assassinations, there isn't a single book, and I have every book on the assassinations, and correct me if I'm wrong, there isn't a single book that bothers to speak about the fact that silencers could be used at Dealey Plaza. Mitchell Werbel works with all the assassination teams of the Nixon, E. Howard Hunt, Watergate, the group that was arrested at Watergate that goes back to the counterintelligence group and started after World War II. Mitchell Werbel, he gives them silencers and weapons and goes all over Rhodesia, Southeast Asia, and so forth. Well, he's got His Majesty King Durrani with him. He's made Mitchell Werbel a lieutenant general and commander of the Royal Free Afghan Army. Now, Mitchell Werbel is a white Russian, a czarist. He wants to invade Russia. They need Afghanistan to circle Russia. That's why Russia took, Soviet Union took Afghanistan, is that the United States is arming Afghanistan and China and the borders to enclose them. And Mitchell Werbel not only is a lieutenant general of the Royal Free Afghan Army, he's been given the Order of the Brilliant Sun. You have to see this paper. Many of you know what a slob he is, with his huge dogs and training centers. And he's hoping, according to this account, and we know, he's hoping to get the monarchies whipped up and to arm them with everything necessary to take Afghanistan. He says that he will work with the monarchies. He says, we have the monarchies in our corner. Monaco, the Council of Princes in Europe, the Monarchist League, Liechtenstein, Luxembourg. And I've mentioned many times that the monarchies are waiting to get back on the throne. Whatever is left of them, they're just a few in number, but they're very well funded and financed, and they sit in the background, the pretenders of every throne, hoping that they can get their seat back. In the meantime, His Majesty Durrani sells cosmetics and perfume for Revlon and Machiavelli scents, and Werbel has accepted Jesus as his savior, and they're waiting for the operation, and they're sending over their weapons, their counter-intrusion system they're arming for Afghanistan, and their computer display, and it will have number and location of weapons and anyone who comes near Durrani. This pretender to the throne left when he was 2 years old. He has somebody competing with him for the throne of Afghanistan. It's similar to the United States putting the Shah in Iran after his father was there and kicked out. We put the Shah in, and this guy is sitting with the monarchies, armed by Mitchell Werbel, who's been active in every counterintelligence operation that ever went against the people. And they're depending on Ronald Reagan to make war in Afghanistan. The article says they're waiting for Ronald Reagan to push them forward. Now, what they want and what they get are two different things. If the CIA pushes Mitchell Werbel and this character into Afghanistan, Russia may just come back and counteract with stronger troops or even atomic weapons. This is going to be an interesting series of years, with the moral majority pushing Reagan one way, the mob wanting favors and nightclub licenses the other, private armies such as Mitchell Werbel's, funded by the CIA, making their little private wars, and Ronald Reagan sitting back there blowing balloons and chewing jelly beans. It's going to be a great year. We're going to have good cartoons again. Saturday Night Live had a picture of the Reagan entourage going somewhere in limousines, and there's Nancy and Ronald, and behind them is the hairdresser, and behind them is the decorator, and behind them are the entourage of help that supply them, the barber, and so forth. And we're going to get some really good humor, because the inconsistencies of this hollow man, propped up by a whole history of political assassinations that has literally robbed us of our choices, is upstage now. He's in the White House with that silly grin and a lot of excuses if he's pushed against the wall. And it's going to be very interesting to watch Ronald Reagan and Nancy as they prance about. They have the place, and there are a lot of people that don't like them, that realize how tacky and empty they are. There's a lot of society people that will be around them because he's the president. And then there's a lot of people that will show up when he's no longer there, that will be the right-hand people of George Bush. Right now they're in the backgrounds waiting, and they will surface very quickly and have prominence again, as they have the CIA then in the throne, and you have George Bush taking over from Reagan. Just briefly, we just have about 4 more minutes. I want to tell you about a book. I mentioned it just briefly and put the address and the title on the sheet that went out with the tapes last week. It's called In Search of the Lindbergh Baby. Is Lindbergh's kidnapped baby son still alive? This is put out by Tower Paperback Books. It is a paperback. The author is Theon Wright. And again, another subterfuge. There are so many cases. You wonder how far back does it go or where does it end? But there is another paperback published 31 years ago by Quentin Reynolds. He's a lawyer, a writer, about another lawyer, Judge Samuel Leibowitz, and it's about famous cases. It's a paperback called Courtroom. It was put out in 1950. It was only 50 cents. And it goes into the Lindbergh kidnapping and the, as I mentioned before, trying to force a confession of a lawyer, and how Randolph Hearst put up the $50,000 ransom, and how there were allegations it involved the Purple Gang and organized crime, and that there was no way that Bruno Hauptmann could have done it alone. And a lot of the conviction was based upon handwriting and ransom notes, and the misspelling of the words was identical to the kind of diary that Lee Harvey Oswald had. And the expert in the case that helped convict Hauptmann was this Osborne, who later went on with certainty and said that Howard Hughes had written memos in 1972 without any doubt. And later Clifford Irving went to jail, and the book and story Hoax tells about it. The world's experts were wrong about the Howard Hughes handwriting and memos that were sent. They were forged. But the same man that said that the Lindbergh notes were accurate said the Hughes notes were accurate. So if he was wrong with one, he could be wrong with the other. As a matter of fact, the woman who owned the Hope Diamond was so anxious to cash in her diamond to help find the kidnappers, Mrs. Evelyn Walsh McLean. She was a millionaire, a social leader in Washington, D.C., and she claimed that Gaston Means, a member of the Department of Justice, was in touch with the actual kidnappers and pawned the Hope Diamond at one time because she felt that organized crime was involved and that it wasn't a Lindbergh baby, and the baby was alive, wasn't killed, and they'd used another baby. So in 1950, there was a book out saying that multimillionaire in Washington and the Justice Department was involved, and the evidence was all half-cocked, and even if Hauptmann was involved, he couldn't possibly have done it alone. And the same people, Randolph Hearst, who put up the money there, the organized crime, run through these stories of other espionage mysteries. And I think the only solution someday that I'm working on is to get a computer and see how many names and incidences run through these episodes, whether it's the Lindbergh story, whether it's the Howard Hughes story, whether it's the Oswald diary. They found a formula, and it worked, and the people believed it. And when you put together old books, whether written 30 years ago or current books, or the Warren Commission report 17 years ago or current stuff, it seems that the same people were using the same subterfuge, and that has worked and kept them in power, and they do have the power. Well, this was a bad inauguration year. It's over. We'll go on to better things next week. We'll continue to expose these frauds. This is Mae Bressel in Carmel, California. You take care, and I'm sure I'll be back next Sunday. No more substitutes unless I can guarantee that they are really good and hopefully maybe work with me, but not pull something like we had last week. You take care. This is Mae, and I'll be back with you next week.
Thank you very much. That's World Watchers International with Mae Bressel, a regular feature here on KLRB, Sunday nights at 10. It's 1 minute after 11 o'clock. We're KLRB, Carmel, Monterey. Good evening.